This is one of a series of presentations made at Shelby Village 9 at Club Med Estapa in Mexico, January 30th through February 6th, 1993.
Dr. Bob got together, said, let's form AA, and that was it, and we lived happily ever after, and it's just been one success after another. And I tell you, the times along the way where this organization should have dissolved are more than you would like to think about. There's some sugar down your spine. Well, most of us know that over the years there have been alcoholism under various names, problem drinking, craziness, insanity drinking, for 4,000 years in recorded history, maybe. And there has been fermented beverages. There's always been some small group of people who seem to react differently or unnaturally. Sometimes they used to put them to death as if they were possessed by evil. And they'd put them, send them away, and they'd imprison them and hide them. And only once in all of history, briefly in the early 1840s, did anybody ever stay sober. And that was the Washingtonians, of course, and I, in case those of you who would like to hear very morning, I want to discuss their case at length. And I talk about the traditions, because they are the roots, in the sense, of our 12 traditions. Jim. I'm not, women won't let me touch the wench. And so, in the early 1930s, when some of us were already alive, when some of us were already functioning, I had to move the microphone myself, you dummy. But thanks for the water. You gotta be nice to him, otherwise your little section of pictures is all out of focus. As we all know the story, in the late 1920s, early 1930s, there was a successful businessman in New York. I really just got a history of him a few months ago. He was even more successful than I had thought, this Roland Hazard. He was in his 40s. He was a successful man. He was a president of several corporations. And he had a good public relations staff because of his obituary in the New York Times and all of his biography never once mentions that he was ever out of town for a year at any one time. But in 1930, his drinking was bad. He could no longer control it very well, although he was protected by a lot of insulation. By 1931, he realized he had to do something, and he had unlimited money to do it for those days. So he looked into and found the most abrupt, he felt, doctor and psychiatrist in the world, who had a sanitarium in Switzerland. And he did not go there for his drinking problem, he went there for his nervous problem, for his emotions, for his, what we would call neuroses. And the doctor was glad to see him, was glad to have finally somebody was there who was willing to go all the way, and be glad to pay for it. And he put him in a hospital, his sanitarium, for a year and worked with him every day. Got to the root of his problems, understood the nature of his illness, really got down. At the end of the year, Roland had really come around. He was prepared to go back and really do a good job. And he was released and started home and didn't even get to his ship. He stopped for one drink. And the next thing he was face down in his own vomit again, sick, and his employees and his wealthy parents had to send and have people come and pick him up, sober him up, and they took him back to the doctor in Switzerland and said, it didn't quite work, could you give him just a little more time? And this doctor, Dr. Jung, said something that day that really was the foundation, in a sense, one of the four foundations, you might call it, of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Yun refused to take him back in the hospital. And he said, but look, I got a blank check. Take what you want. He said, can't help. I realize now I've made a misdiagnosis in your case. I thought you had deep emotional and psychological problems. I see now that you have what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my experience, I don't believe there is any treatment that would be efficient for your situation in the world today at any cost. Now, here's the best doctor and psychiatrist in the world, ostensibly or arguably, and he not only could not heal alcoholics, he had never heard of anybody that could. And, of course, Roland was taken aback by this, something that money could not buy. He said, well, what does it mean, doctor? He said, well, what it means is this, unfortunately. You have to accept the fact that you have to be confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live, or else you must surely intermittently drink until you go insane or die. And that's not the kind of diagnosis you're looking for in the morning. And he said, well, is there no way out? And of course, Dr. Yun gave that famous line about, yes, there have been some cases where there have been involuntary deep psychological reversions, which they describe as some form of spiritual experience. He said, but there's no way to get it. They're very rare. It doesn't seem to happen even to people who study theology. There's just no way to understand it. He said, I'm sorry to think that you'd better keep yourself confined, because nothing else that I can see will help you. So Roland did something that helped us a great deal. He believed the doctor, and he was stunned, and he was shocked. He was so shocked he did not drink. But he went to England on his way home, and he fell into the hands of some people who seemed to be active in working with some kind of a spiritual thing, some members of the Oxford Group. And they told him about the Oxford Group. What the Oxford Group was a kind of a spiritual entity where people tried to get in touch with deeper spiritual reasons. And he stayed sober. And he got on a ship and came back to New York and stayed sober on that ship. And when he got to New York, he looked up the Oxford Group, a place called the Calvary Baptist Church on 23rd Street. Their minister, a guy named Dr. Sam Shoemaker, and began going to the Oxford Group. And he stayed sober. And of course he felt that he owed his sobriety to the Oxford Group. As we will come to see, that is probably not the case, really. Because there are a lot of Oxford Group members who could not stay sober. A doctor in Akron, Ohio, for one. The Oxford Group is kind of an interesting thing to look at, just briefly, it's kind of an odd little thing. It was created in 1908 by a Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania, a guy named Frank Buckman, and he thought, what had really happened to Christianity? And it seems pretty correct sometimes. It got so buried in ritual, it got so buried in form, it got so buried in how the churches lived and what the minister did and the responses, that they forgot the nature of what the hell they were there for. And so he started an organization who wanted to return to what he called primitive Christianity. And he called it the First Century Christian Association. He wanted people to be as enthusiastic and simple as the Christians had been in the catacombs, living, fighting for their faith while the Romans dug it up and burned them. And he little by little grew. And really the cornerstone of the Oxford movement, if you could synthesize it in two words, it was to put aside all of the form and the sense, and just remember these two words, Jesus saves. Jesus saves. Everything else is secondary to that. And he, in the 19-teens, he began to realize It's kind of hard to teach old dogs new tricks. So what he tried to do was plant his movements on the universities of the country. He tried to plant it in Princeton and Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, Penn State. And some people, even a graduate student, took it to Oxford. And for some reason, in Oxford, it really took off, more than in the local universities. And it got to be so widespread that gradually it became known as the Oxford Movement rather than the First Century Christian Association. And this is what it then devolved around. The Oxford Movement was really an American thing that had taken root in Oxford. And so as we know, he went to the Oxford group and he stayed sober. And then began a series of funny little coincidences that just led to shiver down your spine. He stayed sober, and he did all right, and he went back to his business for a while. He went to Vermont from time to time, because that's where his family, and he had started out many years before. He'd get their vacation, relax. And the funny coincidence is, he went there in 1934. Now the odd thing is, he went there for a couple of weeks. Now the odd thing is this, if he'd have gone 2 weeks earlier that year, he just took the dates arbitrarily, if he'd have gone 2 weeks earlier, you and I would not be here this morning. If he'd have gone 2 weeks later, I would be certainly dead or insane, and most of you would too. But by a coincidence, and I'm not going to call it a moment, he happened to be in Vermont vacationing, and his friend that he knew up there named Shep came over and said, hey, our friend that you know, our childhood friend, he's become a terrible drinker like he used to be. His name is Eddie. He was really in the jackpot. He's driven his car drunk into somebody's house where he's been on probation. They are now going to either put him in the state penitentiary or commit him to the state mental hospital for the rest of his life. He's had warning after warning, he's on probation. Could you go over and talk to Ebby? So we went over and talked to Ebby briefly, and Ebby didn't want to hear about it. He thought he could still do it. He said, no, I don't hear religion, I know about that stuff. It isn't that bad. But the next week, Ebby was in court, and it was that bad. And the judge was preparing to send him away. And so Shep said, Jesus, Roland, couldn't you talk to the judge, because he's no friend of your family? It would be fine for me to help Eddie. So Roland talked to the judge. He said, Judge, I know that my friend Eddie here has been a bad guy, and he's really raised heck, and he's a terrible man, but I had some problems with drinking once myself, and I went to the Oxford group in New York. If you will release him in my custody, I will get him to New York, and he won't be around here to get any more trouble. Maybe I can help him. And the judge, but that, I don't suppose he would have done that for anybody else. But he knew Roland Hazard, knew he was wealthy and from New York and from a good family. He said, okay, because it's you, Roland, I will do it. I wouldn't do it for anybody else. If Roland Hazard hadn't been there that week, there would have been nothing going on here. And so he took Eddie back to New York. And all of a sudden, Eddie is a reaction. He wasn't terribly crazed with excitement about it. But he was not terribly crazy to say, don't let go into the Vermont penitentiary either. So it took the edge off a little. But little by little, he started to fit in. There was a place called the Calvary Methodist Church, was down near the Bowery, and they had a Bowery mission next door. And that's where they held their services and had their Oxford movements, and it just, and Eddie got a little going good. And then, as they did in the Oxford Movement. The Oxford Movement did not have any anonymity, in fact, just the opposite. They tried to promote what they were doing. Aggressive evangelism was the series. I mean, getting out of stuff, but aggressive evangelism. You don't have to want it, we're going to tell you. And the time came that you had to publicly go out and do some evangelism. And Ebby really wasn't up for this. He thought, Jesus, I don't want to. That's a little embarrassing. And so you got to do it. That's one of our steps. So we have to remember that in New York, in Brooklyn, was one of his chums, Roland didn't know him, right, from Vermont, but every guy used to drink with was a real renegade, a real loser. He'd lost everything. He was dying out the last he'd heard. A real loser. So I got the address of this guy, Bill Wilson, and arranged to call on him. Made arrangements with Bill to call on him. Now, in our books, Bill talks about how he came to the door, and Bill talks to him, "My Abby looks so good," and he said, "What? How'd you do this, Abby?" And he said, "I got religion." And Bill's interest dropped about 3,000%.
Oh.
Don't you have a drink?
No, I got religion.
Okay.
More for me.
And Abby attempted to tell him about the Oxford group and what he had found in these wonderful steps. And Bill really, he reacted, I hope, the way that you and I would in that same situation. You know, he said, "Gee, could you hand me that bottle there behind you, Abby? Tell me some more, will you?" Now, Abby's recollection of it was that he found it very depressing, because Bill not only didn't get any good out of it, but seemed to reject what he was saying and really hurt him. And he thought, this Bill needs more than this. And so he came back in 2 or 3 days, and he had a much more glib old-timer from the Oxford group with him to do a hard sell on this goof. "She's going to have to do And Bill Wilson reacted, I hope, the way that you and I would react under the same conditions. He went off on one of the worst drunks of his life. "Yes, for real, me answer, great, real ones." He got pretty drunk, and he sat around, and he wound up in his house, came off this terrible drunk. In the midst of this drunk, he thought, "I should go over to see what Roland's doing. Maybe something in this for me." So he sobered up one morning, went over to find the Calvary Church Mission, went up 23rd Street, but just to build up his course, he stopped at each bar along the way and had a little drink. He'd stolen his wife's money out of her purse that morning to show his gratitude. And by the time he got to the Calvary Mission, he was loaded. And he sat in the back with his guys, and he said, "That's so bad, you skid row bums, we're all kind of group." And the minister called upon anyone who'd like to testify. Bill Wilson got up, testified for her. "Just wonderful being here." And he staggered on home, went to bed, stayed in bed for 4 days. And just full of guilt, I acted like such a fool at that terrible mission. I was just such an idiot. I could really empathize with this guy. He was such an imperfect guy. He just, every fault that he has, I have 3 times. And he'd have a few drinks, he had a couple of bottles hidden, so he wouldn't quite go into withdrawal. So he just didn't know what to do. And he just couldn't bear it. And one day he got a hold of Eddie and said he'd like to try to go to the Oxford movement. Incidentally, it's kind of a touching thing. Bill had stayed sober. In September, Dr. Silkworth, his doctor at the town's hospital, had told he and Lois that this is your last goal. You are now going to have to be put into an insane asylum or jail. There's no further hope for you. And this scared Bill Wilson so bad that he did not drink for 5 weeks. And he was just happened to be going down the street on Armistice Day, and one of his old friends from his military unit called him in the bar and said, "Come on in, Bill." "Okay, Bill, nothing to drink." I said, "Come on, it's Armistice Day. You're a veteran. I'll buy you one drink." So, okay. And that's how he happened to be so drunk when Abby found him. And he went to the Oscar group. And he did something that was rather unusual. He didn't go to the Oxford group right away, obviously. He went to the town's hospital first to sober up, so when he went to the Oxford group, he would feel a little better. And we all know that story, too, how in the middle of the night, he had He didn't know what it was, but as he described it later in some of his writings, the wind turned right. Right? There was a wind blowing through my ears. I didn't know what to make of it. I thought I was going crazy. And he called the doctor, and the doctor came up. And Dr. Silkworth, what is it? The doctor said, I don't know. He says, am I sane? That was his first question. Am I sane, doctor? And the doctor had to think about it for a while. He says, I believe you are sane. But I don't know what this is. But whatever it is, you look better than you looked last night. Hang on to it. Hang on to it. So Bill Wilson went out of the town's hospital. And he had what we would call now a true spiritual experience. But they didn't know what it was then. And what saved our life was this. You might say, who's going to have that spiritual experience? It's no good if William went to Vermont and got Abby to come and call him. What's the difference? All that's just experience. It really isn't. Because among the very few people with drinkers who had spiritual experiences, they always seem to get into active in the church work and they never heard from again. But he somehow connected this spiritual experience with every calling on him on the Oxford movement. And so instead of going to the church, he went to find the Oxford movement with the Calvary Mission and felt that somehow he and Ebby were supposed to cure alcoholics. But not what we call alcoholics, called drunkards. And so for the next 6 months, he was in the Oxford movement. He worked very hard. He got very active because he was an obsessed guy, very obsessive guy. He'd get into things. And his poor wife was working as a counter girl, this semi-society woman at one time, Lois Berlin, now down to working in a cart. Her husband wasn't working. She had a hard time supporting him. Now he was bringing home drunks to support them too while he tried to get them sober. But all of a sudden, to many people, rather cold, but he did nothing while she worked. But it never seemed strange to me to work in our family. They would drive home people. And sometimes you had them stay every night. And sometimes you feed them meals. And you try to talk to them. And he's getting skid row people. Bring them to the Oxford group. And the Oxford group was not, even though the Oxford group was a Valerie Mission, they wanted to teach these guys about Jesus saves, not just about how to stay sober. So there was a little conflict there. Not too much. But after that, nobody ever stayed sober that Bill worked with. They couldn't understand why. At the end of 6 months, came the moment where our week at Club Med was just about gone. He got up one morning, the guy he'd brought home the night before, let's stay on the sofa, had gotten up early, stolen some stuff out of the house apparently to sell for wine, and took off. And he didn't know what to do. And he turned to his wife and said, Lois, I'm not going to do this anymore. I thought I had some kind of a calling to help people, but apparently I don't. It's just, the doctor was wrong. I was insane. I had a moment of insanity. That's all it was. I've been trying to help people and working with them and taking them these oxygen meetings for 6 months, and not one person has ever stayed sober. I quit. Not one person stayed sober. And right there, your existence and mine hung by the thinnest thread you can imagine. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. Your history, my history, the world's history, I suppose. I had lunch with her a few years ago in Connecticut. And I said, how in the world did you ever think of that? You're not going to answer. It just changed the course of history. She said, I don't know. Didn't seem like very much to me. It just seemed quite obvious. Because what she said when he said, but when I do these things, not one person stayed sober. She said, you have. And again, oh yes. He said to her, he had stayed sober by helping these people. And so he finally began to realize there was something in what he was doing, but he couldn't make out what. And then he wanted to get a job. He got sick of not being able to job. He got cut some friends into, we're having a proxy battle all of a sudden with a company out west. He said, "I said in Gloucester, I used to be big on Wall Street. I'm sober. I'll get it all straightened out." So they said, "Okay." So it's very time in Akron, Ohio. Now you get out there and get that proxy deal straightened up. And he went out there, and it just was totally screwed up. Everything just went down the toilet. It just was terrible. And one morning he found himself standing in the hotel lobby, walking up and down. It's hot. May 9th, I guess it was. Day before Mother's Day anyway, 1935. He had $10 in his pocket, not even enough train fare to get home to New York. His career was down the toilet. There's no place to turn. I stood in that lobby a few years ago, and I tried to recreate what it must be like. Running in the lobby, there's a little bar, a little gold sign over the front, says cocktails, and inside it looks chewy. And this, he talks about how he's drawn here like a magnet. At the end of the lobby, there's some little payphones on the wall, nickel payphones with some, at least in small town churches, the local churches. And he remembered that they'd given him the name. So you know, he found a church, a minister called Reverend Tunk. He called Reverend Tunk to say, "I'm from New York, and I'm a rum hound, and I have an Oxford movement, and I don't know what the hell to do. And can you help me?" And the Reverend said, "Well, I give you the names of 10 members of the Oxford movement that I know of here in town, Fred Hansen, Red Dunn." So it took 50 cents for one preach call, nickel preach call. And he called them. The first guy he called was some minister, apparently. He said, "I'm a rum hound from New York. I didn't help you." I said, "I really very sorry for you, sir, but I can't help you. I'm writing this sermon. Please call me some other time." Hung up. And I'll tell you, I don't know about you, if that had been me, I might have said, "Well, I did what I could, folks." And I'll tell you, I would hate to have AA depend on me being rejected when I'm hot, sick, depressed, and lonely. He called the next one. There was no answer. And the next one didn't have time to talk to him. The next one said, "I'm not familiar with them, Hans. Please don't bother me." And this went all the way down. And the 10th name on the list, the least likely one, was Henrietta Cyberly, who was a daughter of a wealthy and famous Akron family, Cyberling Powers. She said, "Funny, I've been worrying myself sick for a year now about my family doctor. I can't help him to stay sober. He's in our Oxford group too, but I can't help him stay sober. Would you say you're sober in the Oxford group? Perhaps you could come and meet him. Would you come out and talk to me?" So Bill went out to Henry's and Cyberling's house, sat in her guest house with her, talked to her. Henry had his size to not realize he was sober, he wasn't after anything probably. Called up Dr. Bob's house, her friend Ann Smith, said, "Could you bring the doctor out?" Ann had explained she couldn't right then. She didn't want to go into details, but it turned out that he was asleep under the coffee table in the living room. He had brought home a potted plant, and he was a little more potted than the planet. She said, "We'll be out tomorrow." So Henrietta let Bill use the guest room of the Humanitarian guest house. The next day, Dr. Bob, his wife, and his son, 16-year-old son, drive him out there. And he was so sick that he was shaking so bad, and he needed a drink so bad. And I said, "You can't have the nut in front of Henrietta." And he said, "Make me a promise. I won't have to talk to this guy more than 10 or 15 minutes." "Jesus, I can't. I'm so sick." You got to just visualize these people. These weren't saint-like people. They were people like you and me, weak and fallible and just at any moment ready to go. And he got out there. He was just good from New York. And Henrietta answered, "Well, we didn't want to do that. Why don't you two men go in the other room and talk and we'll have coffee?" That's about 15 minutes. And they internet. And Bill Wilson got talking to him about his experiences as a drinker. And as Dr. Bob wrote later, The man wasn't here to save his soul or tell him Jesus saves. He had never heard anyone who really understood what it was like to be a drinker. And the 15 minutes came and went, and then an hour came and went, and 2 hours, and 3 hours, and 4 hours. Some of you sometime may hear of young Dr. Bob Smith, not young Dr. Bob, but Bob Smith Jr., Dr. Bob's son, who's now in his mid-70s, lives in Texas. I like him, good friend of mine. Because when he's the only surviving member of that meeting, he explained that it really was not, didn't look like he was made in heaven at the moment. I thought, what's going on? If they finally thought maybe they're both in their drinkers, maybe he smuggled a bottle in there. And so Dr. Bob was so thrilled and had some hope. He said to Bill, could you possibly stay here for a while longer? Could you stay at our house? Maybe we could talk some more. And I said, and Bill, I'm sure it helped him to have the knowledge he didn't have trained for home. Yes, I believe I can stay, Bob. And so we moved into Dr. Bob's house. And for the next 2 or 3 weeks, they studied spiritual meanings and understandings and discussed with each other how they felt. And it really was wonderful. And we all know the story that happened then. There was an annual medical convention in Atlantic City. And Dr. Bob said, I didn't think I'd be able to go this year because my drinking's been so bad, but I can go now and tell them what we found. You go, Bob. And Bill and Mrs. Smith and the boy and girl daughter stayed home and they went off. He went. And a few days later, Mrs. Smith got a call at 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, from Dr. Bob's office nurse. She'd been called up at a railroad station. Come down and get the doctor. He's drunk on the platform, laying face down on the platform. They can't move him. So she went down and brought him to the office where he lay on the floor. And then she called Mrs. Smith, who was just overcome. And so she and Bill Wilson went down to the office to see what to do. And again, right then, folks, it didn't look like we'd be going much to Club Med that morning, I'll tell you. It was pretty bad because it was a very, very thin line. And they brought him home. And the nurse also said, you know, in about 3 days, we have to do surgery because Dr. Bob was a cancer surgery. Had to do a colon cancer surgery. It had to do it. There's no way out. So they tried in the next 3 days to nurse him off, to taper him off, to give him coffee, to sober him up. And then finally after 3 days, they got him up and his hands were shaking. My God, I can't do surgery like this. What the hell could I do? My God, what am I going to do? So they took him down to the hospital anyway. As he got off, tried to go in the hospital, his sponsor did something for him. But I knew about years later that's my sponsor to do for me, and he wouldn't do it. So his sponsor gave him a drink. But this will steady your hands down, Bob. So he took the drink and went in, and Bill and Ann went home, and they had no idea. Was he able to do the surgery? Did he kill the patient? Was he, my God, what are we going to do? And the hour of the operation was 12:30. They didn't hear from him. One, two, they hadn't heard from him. Three, they hadn't heard from him. Four, none of them knew what had happened. He got some money and got drunk. And what the hell could they do now? And all of a sudden, here comes Bob into the house. And he looks like $1 million. He said, the operation went good. I felt so good afterwards. I felt so good about our talks. So what I've done for the whole day long, I went to all the creditors that I've been dodging for the last year. I spent the afternoon telling them I'm going to pay them even if it takes $1 a month. I've made retribution to everybody that I owe in Akron. And they were quite thrilled. But then something else happened that changed the course of their life. It came to the realization, of course. Sitting around and discussing deep spiritual matters is very nice. But that's not how Bill Wilson stayed sober in New York, and Dr. Bob hadn't been able to stay sober doing it that way in Akron. So they decided to have to find some poor boob to call up. And they knew a guy named Bill D., who was a lawyer from Kentucky and called a Southern Action. He'd been come to Akron as a geographic, brilliant guy. He'd been a city councilman. He'd been a good lawyer. He little by little dragged himself into deep trouble. And he had been lectured to by everybody about his drinking. And he was married to a strong woman, too, who lectured him considerably. And 10 years ago, I heard him talk. I went up to him after and said, "Gee, how are you doing, Bill?" And his wife said, "He's fine." It made me homesick, actually. But anyway, here's these two guys for Akron who wanted to talk about his drinking. And he didn't want to talk to them. But his wife compelled him, in a sense. So they put in his heat. He said later, you know, kind of funny, he said, "I was laying in a hospital bed an hour and a half. And my wife said she wanted me to talk to these two fellows about my drinking. And I didn't want to talk to nobody about my drinking. A sick of it. But she insisted, so I talked to them. And then the other fellows never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt and what it did to them. And I never heard of anybody describe me that well. I was so impressed, I couldn't believe it. I began to tell them a little bit about me, too. And I've been so impressed with them fellows, I've been with them ever since." And they had Alcoholics Anonymous member, of course, Gene Gallup back then, who had the third member of their little Oxford group cadre of non-drinkers. And they called on other people. Some people got drunk and some didn't. Because I ran across one young guy, kind of Ernie, eventually, who was a young man. Most of these guys were in the 40s or late, Bill Wiss was 39 when he got sober. Most people were all older than that. And this young guy, the first young guy, and he came to AA, where they brought him to the meetings. And he did something that he kind of brought the poisoned apple into the Garden of Eden, some people think. He fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. Now that wasn't so bad, except he brought into what was now AA, its first relationship. I don't know the single word, I don't know the single word that any sponsor more turns white at than you can think of the phone and hear them say, "I want to talk to you about my new relationship." If you're real quick, you could say something like, "Oh, Mr. Emerson and Indebury, you go home a long time ago. They know her right there." I said, "No, this is really the one." He said, "I tell you, I thought the word master was good. Why should I just go come and walk him out of detox? I just knew him." he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter, and they got married, which is a lovely thing. As I said, I've told the story a lot of times, it would seem like an ideal situation. My youngest daughter married a guy that I sponsored. They met at my house, and they went together for a while, and they got married. And I want to tell you something. If there ever was a textbook example of mixed emotions, it's watching your daughter go down the aisle with a man whose fifth step you've heard. Yeah. Yeah. You can't really say anything, but you can give little hints like that. "Let me know if you ever been to Sheep Farm, honey." Yeah. But he married Dr. Bob's daughter, and since he had run the family, he didn't have to do all the running around the others did, because he was not so frantic as they were, apparently. So he kind of became more of a husband and less of a recovering alcoholic. And so they were really surprised when he got drunk and died, because they didn't know that the three members of the family won't keep you sober. They found out. And in a sense, seeing the parent that made her bitter towards AA for 30 years. Only the last few years that she'd come around and remember, the son never had any strong feelings against him or for it until she had a difficult time with it. And so that's, now there are a few alcoholics there enacting. And we're going to you would think, well, I often said this to you, and I would talk to young Bob Smith, I said, boy, that must have really been wonderful for you. 16 years old, and you're present at the birth of one of the greatest spiritual experiences in the world's history. And it's happening right in front of your eyes. These two guys, bringing guys to Bob's home, Dr. Bob's home, put them on the sofa, put them in paraldehyde, put them upstairs, keep them around, get them sober, just, and the whole world changes. And young Bob says, no, I didn't see that way to me. I thought it was a big pain in the butt. I'm glad to see my dad sober, but he was a periodic, he was sober a lot anyway. Anyway. And this guy from New York was a nice guy, but a little intense for my taste. And he said, you know, you come home, you couldn't ever bring anybody home from school, or there'd be some guy laying on the sofa smelling like paraldehyde. Sometimes a guy would be shimmying down the drain pipe trying to get away from these two fanatics. Who I just thought he was hideous. And, well, God punished him, as you know, for his lack of short-sightedness, or for his short-sightedness. He never drank much himself. He married an alcoholic, and eventually wound up in Al-Anon. I think God overreacted, but... So eventually, after a few months, Bill went back to New York. And he got involved in some little people in, doing some people in the Oxford group in New York. And little by little, they got a few here and a few there and a few drank and a few drink. Most of the stories, because they're in my literature. And in late 1937, Bill's brother-in-law was able to set up a meeting with some of the Rockefeller people to see if they could get some gold to build some hospitals and pay Dr. Bob's rent, among other things. And they wouldn't spend any day and slipped them $5,000 to pay their current expenses, but said the money was for them. In 1938, Bill and Dr. Bob got together one more time again and decided something has to be done. We really want to help our parishes going so slow. What we really need to do is set up some hospitals, have some alcoholic counselors, and write a lot of literature about what we're doing so people will know. And the members of the group, really, they're always discussing things with the members of the group. The members of the group didn't like this idea. It's talking about group conscience. For no particular reason. Sounds intellectually correct. But Bill finally persuaded them that maybe they could do it. He'd write a book. The proceeds would be so great that they could build the hospitals and get that answer. And they didn't really want to do it, but they did. So in 1938, Bill Wilson wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we've all read about it, we've read it, we've talked about it a lot. And the book itself is kind of an object of affectionate joking in AA. Because most of us come here and say that, when I first came here, I found that book to be very badly written. I expect some to appreciate it. I made my living most of my life as a writer, my earlier years, and I still write a wonderful fundraising letter every Christmas for the Midnight Mission. I tell you how wonderful it is. I don't dare proofread it because I keep writing checks every time I write it through. Yeah. May not be actually true, but it should be. Well, first came to AA in 1939. The guy was helping me, tried to get me to read the book, and I read it. And I didn't find it badly written. I found it just interminably dull. Just a dull, endlessly dull book. You know? And I just didn't think much about it. Some years later, when I came off Skid Row, I was back in AA again. My new sponsor had me read the book. And I'll tell you, this time when I read that book, I found it to be deadly dull, just endlessly dull. I write things like, say, feel now, make this fail, poison, feel, and there's nothing like, there's no call to action the whole book. Really, just one great page after another. Feel fail, distance, real development. So I didn't say much just that book. I did actions, my sponsor insisted on, and later I discovered there were actions from the book.
1938 by Alcoholics Anonymous founder. But over the years, as I like to say, I've come to believe that it's hard for an old ex-cynic like me to say this in a sense, but I've come to believe that the book Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the, if not the only one, certainly one of two books that I've ever read that I truly believe to be divinely inspired. I believe the book Alcoholics Anonymous is divinely inspired for one simple reason. The guy who wrote it didn't know enough to write it. He has a background in psychology, abnormal psychology. He had a background in to see little traces of that, the traces of the other little things he read throughout that book. The steps are not really indigenous entirely to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of things. But when he put together a book in a narrative form that has done something that we sometimes forget is so miraculous. What makes it it's a miracle, you know. The word miracle has become cheapened a lot, I think, sometimes by people who see miracles in everyday life. I got up early this morning, and I watched the sun come up with the pine trees. I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day. And I'm an old curmudgeon. I feel like saying, well, get up early tomorrow morning, you'll see another one. Jesus, you know, that's a big deal. It's been going on for a billion years now. Miracles are things to me which have no natural explanation. And the miracle of the book Alcoholics Anonymous is this. It has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 53 and a half years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. And we forget that. And we sometimes want to debate if that book knows what it's talking about. Is it really right? Shouldn't we change it to agree with some loser who's been here 10 minutes and doesn't think it's right? But that book was written. And he would talk about it to his friends, and they'd argue and debate and on and on. He finally wrote it, as most of us have seen it, in the manuscript form. Many of us have seen that. And he had about 100 copies run off. And he sent it to various doctors, psychiatrists, members of the groups in other towns, and he asked them for their opinions of it. Some of the guys sent it back, just great, several doctors. One doctor in New Jersey, oddly enough, changed the face of AA in a sense. He said, in chapter 5, I don't think you ought to say, you must do that in the 12 steps. You should say, here is what we have done. We admitted we were powers of well, not you must admit you. Just think that came from a non-alcoholic source. And he incorporated this. Then, of course, he had this hard-nosed in his group, two hard-noses who were a heartache to him. One was his right, the first guy he got sober in New York, that named Hank P. And the other guy, Jim B., Jim Burwell. Jim Burrow was an atheist, and Hank P was a pain in the butt, is what he was, but he was his oldest baby. Incidentally, we have somebody get mixed up in AA about the pigeons and babies. In New York, for some reason that nobody can figure out, they call them pigeons. In Akron, for some reason nobody can figure out, they call them babies. So that's why in the Western United States, most of them are known as babies, and the Eastern are known as pigeons, I guess. But anyway, Orwell convinced him that too much God was, there were kind of three elements. There were some of the real old, sturdy, Oxford group guys that said, why are you trying to avoid the fact that Jesus is what saves? We are here through the Oxford group because Jesus saves. Why use God? Say Jesus. And then there were people in the middle who says, well, We can't really say Jesus because we want to help people maybe who don't believe in Jesus per se, but because they're alcoholics or Jewish and maybe Muslims. But we should say God. Maybe we could say God as you understand them. And then there are the real other fanatics, the other side says, we don't want to talk about any God, we don't talk about any higher power, nothing. We're talking about the psychological reasons for drinking, and once they're in here a while, then we'll give them a little God after a while. The trouble with AA has always been the same. It's full of alcoholics, and every one of them knows something. Every turn of every group in the world. Now wait a minute! I want to be heard on this subject! Shut up! Your sponsors explain. And, but they would finally decide upon the form we see it. God as we understand Him. A God that would not be terribly offensive. God that would not... They were already starting to pull away a little bit from the Oxford group, because the Oxford group had certain attributes. The Oxford group didn't like the book. They were still a member of the Oxford group, but they liked the book, so they said, you're making it sound as though Jesus is not the right answer. You're making it different. But they had a book. And they, as most of us know, it's a kind of a funny story. They finally got the book. Guy from the publishing firm offered Bill Wilson $1,500 advance to print it. And Bill Wilson turned it down. He thought, no, then I'll have to go to rights to this guy. We'll do it ourselves, but we'll keep all the profits and we can build the hospitals. And he really needed the money for his rent, too. He was in tough shape. In fact, he was evicted shortly thereafter, he and his wife. But he called us up, Works Publishing Company. He sold stock. There's still stock certificates around. I don't know if anybody ever collected any of them. But just Works Publishing, because it works. And they published, they borrowed the money and published this book. They got the money from the stock sales. And then they had all these books. And as you know, they decided they didn't want to charge for it. Some guy says, a dollar. Let's let everybody know. And Bill Wilson said, no, 3.5. One of them think you're really getting something. But that's such a small book. It's not worth 3.5. Well, and then they decided to put some stories in on the end of it to back it up a little bit. And they helped too to show that AA works. And then they went to the printer, most of you know the story, and said, put it on the heaviest paper we got. Make that some bitch look big. And that first got his name, Big Book. That first book was pretty thick. It was like turning over a New York Times every page. And it came out. And then the final coup d'etat, this Hank P. went out and got $500 and bought a lot of postcards and sent them to every physician and doctor and counselor east of the Mississippi. And says, here's your chance, baby, to learn about saving alcohol. And they were so excited about it that they didn't even go down, they didn't want to go to the post office box to get the orders for a few days because they wanted to get them, so they brought a big sack down to pick them up. And their net response to their postcards were 12 pieces of mail. Two ridiculed them, several. A couple of them, physicians, were illegible, assuming the doctors were drunk. Several people laughing at them, and there were two orders for books at the bottom. And so the big deal, the big experiment was over. It didn't work. They sold a few to the members. They could afford it. Things were so bad at this time they decided they had to do something to get some financial stability. So they had took three or four guys who'd been in that Rockefeller dinner and asked them to be the kind of general board or the board of control for AA, the predecessor of our general service board. So these guys would act as their financial advisors, dole about a little money now and then, this and that, but it really was just hideous. By 1939, things were tough. Things were tough in Akron. They were getting a little upset with the Oxford movement. New York, they're getting upset with the Oxford movement. We're getting upset with them. So the Oxford group really had four basic attributes that AA was absolutely, what turned out to be AA, was against. They were strong evangelism, no anonymity, just the opposite, public knowledge, public testifying, a unity of purpose, so there was no divergence, and the four absolutes, which was the cornerstone of the Oxford movement. And most of you have heard of those, what they are. They preach this. Whatever you do, you must accept these things and become this absolutely. Absolute purity. Absolute honesty. Absolute, say, love, and absolute, something that begins with you, I know it well, but I can't, it weighs my mind enough. Unselfishness, right. Unselfishness. I'm so unselfish myself, I can't remember the word. And this was just the opposite of what Bill Wilson and his alcoholic self. Because he felt, when you deal with alcoholics, I mean, the goals are wonderful, but the big problem with alcoholics, they are all perfectionists, they are all absolutists, and that's what makes them drunk half the time. We've got to stay away from alcoholics becoming absolute somethings, or absolute this, or absolute that. So they gave up on the absolutes, that made the Oxford group upset. They finally broke away. And in Cleveland, Ohio, there was a wild hare named Clarence Snyder, who got sober with Dr. Bob and kept sending people down there. But he got upset with the Oxford group because he felt that they were keeping Catholics out. And in fact, the Catholic Church finally banned Catholic members from attending Oxford group meetings in Akron, Ohio. So they had to set up something different. So he set up a little group where they didn't have any connection to the Oxford group, and he called it Alcoholics Anonymous, taking the name off the manuscript. And it's kind of a sad thing. Years later, he spent the declining years traveling the country saying, I'm the real founder of AA, not Bill Wilson. I've got articles sent to me, big front page of the Wichita Beacon. Clarence Snyder, big picture, founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, visits Wichita. And it's just sad because it's such a piece of nonsense. But anyway, it little by little grew. And the Oxford group, as it disappeared, Alcoholics Anonymous grew very slowly. Most of us know the story of what happened then. They got a story in Liberty magazine in 1939 to try to help them, and it was a big flop because in Liberty magazine they attributed AA's success to religion, and that just frightened off everything about religion. 1941, most of you know this story too, Jack Alexander had just got done doing his tremendous expose of the dock rackets in Philadelphia, because he was their dock racket specialist. They said, there's this group called Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't know if they're legitimate or not, but it sounds like a scam. Go do a racket story on them. And he went over there, and make a long story short, Bill Wilson took him to Cleveland, took him to Akron, showed him what was going on in New York, and it just floored this group, this Jack Alexander, because he was prepared to find something entirely different. And he wrote in the March issue of the Serving Post of 1941 this glowing story about AA, which changed the course of history, in effect. And Alcoholics Anonymous began to get letters and cards from everywhere. That year was a tremendous year. Now, there had been AA before that had gotten out. But AA was going through a terrible time. Probably another great moment when Alcoholics Anonymous very nearly could have expired is one that is not in our literature, and very few people know it is in our literature, but doesn't put as pronounced as it is in some of the other historical pieces. Early in 1940, Bill Wilson and his wife had been given two little rooms above a tawdry clubhouse they were running on 24th Street in New York. He had no job. He had nothing going for him. She was working. His number one follower, Hank P., had gotten drunk because he got resentful of Bill Wilson, was traveling around the groups of the Eastern United States saying, Bill Wilson is stealing the AA money and is hitting on the AA girls. Let's get rid of that son of a bitch. There was a movement in Cleveland to ban AA, Bill Wilson, from AA in January 1940. I mean, it really, everything he touched was like it turned to crap. And he was sitting there, just couldn't imagine. He had tried to do everything he could to help people. And all he realized he couldn't drink, but there was some, for a person of that personality, I don't think it would be a big jump to say there may have been a suicidal thought or two going through his mind. Because everything he touched had gone to hell. And there was a knock on the door downstairs, and somebody said, there's a guy here to see you. And for the first time since he started AA, he started to say, I don't want to see anybody. Leave me alone. But then he thought, no, I can't do that. Not a good example. Send him up. And this old guy comes shuffling up, and he's got a big overcoat. I said, God, another Skid Row bum to tell me a story. I'm sick of them. The guy took off his coat, and he had a collar underneath. He was a priest. He said, my name is Father Dowling. I'm from St. Louis. And I've heard about your good works. I do a publication out there, and I want to talk to you about the spiritual aspects of it, because I think it's fascinating. That pricked Bill up a little, so they sat down, and they talked for a long time. And little by little, Bill Wilson told him all of his problems. He wrote later, I'd written about the fifth step, but I believe that was the first time I ever took one. And he said, I talked to him for hours. I got such a sense of freedom and relief. I began to realize what I've been doing. I've been trying to control everything. I've been trying to demand. I wasn't great. I kept thinking that I'd saved Dr. Bob. I forgot completely that I'd gone there to save myself. I called on Dr. Bob to keep me sober, not to keep him sober. And everything's been such a gift, and I demand more. It put my whole life, changed it in perspective. So this non-alcoholic, in a sense, changed the course of history one more time. How did anybody know that they were that close to 1940? And the one other thing, of course, that happened after the publication of the book is that the book was pretty much the way it is now, except for the you must and so on. But there was one change made in the 12th step that they thought should be made. After the book came out, it was pretty well written on Bill's experiences. Some of the members of AA came up to him in 1940, 39, said, Bill, this is not correct. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I said, yeah. He says, you're the only one who's had a spiritual experience. We haven't had any. You had it in Towns Hospital. You didn't have it as a result of those steps. You had it 3 years before you wrote the steps. He said, when we get our spiritual experience, we try to do these things, we're trying to help others, but what is this? And Bill was, that's right. And he began to realize he was the only one that had the spiritual experience of the type he described. They were that rare. And he mulled about it and thought about it. Fortunately, the book sold so slowly they had a lot of time to think about it. And finally, it began to develop within his mind and to some of his followers. They didn't quite identify it thoroughly, but they begin to sense something. They begin to sense something. That a spiritual experience may be necessary, but it's not the type of spiritual experience that Bill Wilson had, because they're so rare. And I don't know if they thoroughly understood this or not, but I'm sure you and I could defend this today very clearly with the wisdom of retrospect. Probably the great aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous that makes it so unusual is that in the 12 steps and its various actions, it is the only thing in history that has brought about an incremental spiritual experience. Not, boom, the way Bill Wilson got his, but the way we get ours. Make amends for that bitch? And little by little, find the changed perception that comes with it. And so in the 12th step of the second printing, they changed the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. This morning at the Attitude Adjustment Hour, the subject seems to be pretty much the spiritual awakening. And everyone has different experiences in that field. What makes Alcoholics Anonymous so unusual and so different from the actual group in so many places? We are entitled to complete freedom of our own spiritual awakening. There is no way to do it. You do it here by taking actions and being involved. So little by little, Alcoholics Anonymous worked. They had only one really tremendous crisis to face. They had other crises, but probably the most severe crisis came in the next couple of years. But AA was expanding by leaps and bounds. What they used to do is send people out and go talk to them. Send a guy, I see Sandy back there in the early 1940s, a guy in Washington, D.C., and he'd ride the train every week, come up to New York, go to a meeting, go back and tell them what's going on. People came in from Boston on the train once a week to the meeting, Wednesday night meeting, went back and told them what's going on. There was, the schism, of course, was this. There was a tremendous schism between the New York AA and the Akron AA. Not between Bill and Dr. Bob, but between their followers. And it really had gotten quite serious. For example, in Chicago, they would send guys into Akron twice a month, but they would never go to New York because they didn't like those people. And there got to be a lot of divisiveness. There got to be people that they hadn't been able to get to in Los Angeles. Some of you know the story how it got to Los Angeles. A woman whose brother got sober somehow in the Oxford group of New York with Bill Wilson, came to Los Angeles, and she had one of those manuscripts of the book that they served out. And she didn't know how AA worked, but she knew that her brother was sober, so she advertised in the Los Angeles paper, "Ladies, do you have a husband with a drinking problem? If so, call me," and I said. And so they set up, the wives set up a meeting for their husbands on the mezzanine room of the Hotel Cecil down on Main Street in Los Angeles. Any of you can go down there and see the hotel still. I've got the mezzanine, try to imagine what it must be like. These women bring in their husbands and they, "You go in there." And the ones with the manuscripts, "Well, what are you supposed to do?" "I don't know. I've never been to a meeting. But here's your book. You sit in there and do what you can. I'll wait out with your wives." Auspicious beginning, huh? And they sat in there, a guy named Morty Josephs, who lived many, many years later. But he looked at us, "I don't have to live." You guys said, no. So he leaped to it. He thought, "Well, maybe this will help." And he read this aloud because it seemed to be appropriate. And whether by divine intercession or luck or coincidence, he read the portion of chapter 5 that you heard last night. That's where it came from. They didn't know how to start the meeting, and they read a portion of that chapter 5 because it said how it works. Then he decided they'd discuss that for a while. And they did. And for many, many years, Los Angeles was the only place in the country that read chapter 5. Then little by little it infiltrated down all over the world. He went down to New Zealand in some meetings, and that's pretty interesting because up to 4 years ago in New Zealand, they wouldn't even say the Lord's Prayer. I mean, they're autonomous. But chapter 5, and they got a little group going. They didn't know what the hell they were doing. Pretty soon, most of them got drunk. Then they started AA again. 1940, a different place. 1941, they started another little group. And they wound up with, again, 12 members by coincidence. And they did then something that they kind of sounds interesting now. Most of them were veterans of the First World War. One of the things they did in the First World War in the American Army, everybody had a buddy. So whenever you're in a battlefield, no one would be left behind. Your buddy would look out for you, you would look out for him. That's where the song "My Buddy" comes from, saying about the guy that took care of you. Well, so they put these alcoholics on the buddy system. "You keep your buddy sober, and you keep you sober, and I'll see you at the meeting Friday night." Okay. Well, One of the guys, a milkman, who later got sober and was a long-term member of AA in Los Angeles, got drunk one day in a fit of upset. So he called his buddy, and his buddy came over, and he felt so bad about him that he got drunk too. So they called up Marty Joseph and said, could you send over a couple more guys? We're in trouble. So they sent over two more guys. And an hour later they called in. All four of them were drunk. And so they sent, two or four more anyway. And I heard the guy tell the story a long time ago. And they went over there. And pretty soon they called in and they were all drunk. And they called Marty Joseph and said, Marty, you'll have to bring the rest of the guys over. We'll help us. And Marty said, no, you've just about wiped out AA Western Mississippi. You guys are on your own. Good luck. And some of them got back and some of them died. It was always the case. It's kind of funny, but they're funny because we know how it came out. It couldn't have been funny going through it when you're the only one for thousands of miles who's sober and your buddy's drunk. It was tough because these guys were as weak as you and I are. We like to think that they were inspired. They weren't. They were weak, fallible people. Bill Wilson was a bedeviled, weak, fallible person with great inspiration, but a weak, fallible person. Dr. Bob was an introverted, fallible, weak man. But little by little, it evolved. So I started to say the next big thing that happened, it got so big everywhere, it had 8,000 members, 10,000 members, 12,000 members, that pretty soon everybody used to get their own way. And people were having their pictures taken. Bill Wilson was amongst them for a while. He went on a publicity tour and appeared in newspapers as founder of AA. And all kinds of problems were happening. And they almost came apart. That was the last major crisis. And that day, that year, that period of time, is when, after much soul searching and experimentation and reading and discovering things I never knew before, they brought the other aspects of AA into business. They brought the 12 traditions, which the evolving of the 12 traditions are just, it's just a fascinating story. It's just more fascinating almost than the history of AA because it's so simple yet so complex. And little by little AA grew. And we all know what happened after that. It got bigger. Finally, in 1950, they had the first international convention. By 1955, Bill Wilson went to the international convention in St. Louis. Said, I hereby stepping down as head of AA. It's got to be a membership thing. The General Service Conference is now in charge and the Board of Trustees. 1960, they had a big... And I can tell you, what relatively short time AA has been in existence. In 1960, I was at the International Convention in Long Beach. My sponsor made me go. I was a year and a half sober. And I didn't want to go. But I went to that Friday night meeting, and I'll tell you, in retrospect, it was such a tremendous thing. Because all the people I've been talking to you about, except Dr. Bob, spoke that night. Sam Shoemaker, Ebby, who had never stayed sober, got sober drunk. At that moment was sober 7 years, the longest he'd ever stayed sober, and shortly after that got drunk again. Lois. All the people you read about at AA Comes of Age were all stood up one after another and talked. It's like going to Gettysburg and say, we're going to hear from Abraham Lincoln tonight. You know, just, I came out of there crying. It was a conversion experience to me. Another guy in AA named Eddie Regan, an old timer, who'd been trying to help me a little bit, and he said, we went all the way back downtown without talking. He said, you can't talk after that. And we both were crying. Who'd imagine a cynical puke like me would be crying at the base of a meeting? And by 1965, something Bill Wilson had wanted for 10 years, but they had fought against, they finally had a majority of AA service board become alcoholics. See, that's such a small thing, but they all said we can't be trusted, the alcoholics felt. But Bill Wilson convinced them they could. And Bill Wilson, in the late 1950s, wrote AA Middle of the 50s, wrote AA Comes of, wrote the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, because he felt the book was still wonderful, but It was subject to interpretation a little bit in some parts of it. It became more like a Bible than a working vehicle. So he wrote the 12 and 12 to bring us about. Then he wanted history, so he wrote A Comes of Age. By 1965, at the end of the 1965 convention in Toronto, Bill Wilson stepped down to all intents and purposes. And by that moment, Alcoholics Anonymous was a functioning gyration. It's kind of an interesting thing. This is not at all meant critical. It's just the interesting thing that Bill Wilson always was an intense person. And once he had stepped down in charge of AA, as it were, in 1955, he became obsessed with different things. He kind of got into spiritualism sometimes. We thought maybe he could communicate with the dead. Not a big deal, but a little bit. Some guys from Canada, University of Saskatchewan, convinced him in 1957 and 58 that they had isolated a drug that would help alcoholics break through their deep inner psyche. They'd been trying to do with alcohol, but they couldn't, and they had the drug to do it. And they said, this will work. Now, I'll tell you my personal experience with this. At the end of 1958, I was living in an abandoned car back at the AA Club in Los Angeles. Some people came from UCLA, and they wanted 10 known alcoholics to go to UCLA, take the experiment dealing with this drug, and possibly be cured of alcoholism. And I knew they had clean beds and 3 meals a day, so I volunteered. But it looked so bad, it didn't be front teeth, and looked grubby, and they wouldn't even take me. I wasn't up to the standard of their stinking drug. So they took 10 people out there. And these 10 people were given massive doses of LSD to cure them of alcoholism. They didn't know what it was, just lysergic acid. They thought this would help them. Some of those guys died. I know one survivor, also in Sears, who was down in Seal Beach now. And then later on, Bill talked to him, and he tried LSD and realized that was not what they were. I mean, how could Bill try LSD? He wasn't trying this for a kick. He was trying to help alcoholics. Then he got into B3, niacin, and that became the great obsession of late 1950s, early 1960s. In fact, most of you wouldn't remember this, but it was a big thing around AA among the in-groups to take massive doses of niacin. You'd often throw it with flushed faces, and then just everybody. And he said, you shouldn't do that. And they put up a letter from Bill Wilson saying, Bill Wilson says I should. Who the hell are you to say I shouldn't? Not much you can say about that. And the sad thing was that finally the World Service Board had to ask Bill Wilson to stop using the World Service Office and its letterheads. If you want to peddle niacin, that's your business, Bill, but you can't do it on our letterheads. You got to do it somewhere else. And we prefer you didn't do it over your own name because you're known as the founder of AA. And so he had to stop using the World Service Office to disseminate this information. And he once upon a time said one of the thrills of his excitement, kind of an exciting thing, is if I'm known for anything, it will be known for publicizing niacin, not for founding AA. He was a little long on that. But eventually he died in January 1971, as most of you know. He made his last talk in 1970 at the International Conference of Miami Beach. I remember sitting there thinking what a remarkable thing to feel about in a wheelchair. He wanted to get up and say a few words, and he reinforced the same things he had said in 1940, 1945. Not about niacin or LSD, about the unity. We must have unity. Without unity, we are lost. Hank, his nemesis had died long ago. Abby had died long ago. Everybody had died. And here's a guy saying, unity is what tells us true. So Alcoholics Anonymous continues to flourish. And in a real sense, the one thing we've got to remember is this. The one thing that will enable us to flourish, that will keep us from all the side effects that destroy organizations like us, that keep us from the churches that Dr. Bookman was trying to get away from in 1908, are the 12 traditions. And they are so vital today that it's almost staggering. The history of AA is interesting because it's human beings and they're not God-like creatures. They're stumbling, fallible human beings. But this is not anywhere near as vital to us as the 12 traditions, which are absolutely imperative if we are to survive. But at least we have a history of three-dimensional people, sometimes failing, many, many more people getting drunk than staying sober. There was once upon a time when people were so happy about how many people were staying sober in AA, maybe 20,000. He said, how about the 600,000 we weren't able to help? We've got to find something for them. So we live today, hardly ever stopping to think that once upon a time, Abby happened to think of Bill Wilson's name out of nowhere, and that Roland was sufficiently frightened to find the Oscar group, and that Bill, Ed Dowling, decided that night to call him Bill Wilson, who might have committed suicide before dawn, and all the things that have gone to enable us to walk out on the beach in the sun today, with a degree of dignity and freedom that we don't really deserve, but God's grace has given to us. And once in a while, we can take a minute and think, a lot of people gave their lives and their sanity so we could be here today. So we must not ever be too busy to pass on the gift to those behind us. Thank you.
We respectfully request to honor the traditions of your fellowship in the use of these materials, if you would. Fast forward the cassette probe unit for safekeeping in its storage container. Thank you.